Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Today, we're combining it with nature power. How is this going to be the case? Well, bird medicine. That's right, bird medicine, the sacred power of bird shamanism. This book absolutely fascinated me because it brings in a whole different perspective of how the Native American culture, and actually it represents many cultures throughout the world, that had such a deep relationship with the natural environment that they lived in, of which birds are a significant participant. My guest today is Evan Pritchard. He is a descendant of the Mi'kmaq people. He has taught Native American studies at Pace University, at Vassar College, and Morris College. And he is the director of the Center for Algonquin Culture. Now, one of his relatives, a very special aunt, taught him a lot about the stories of birds, the different birds, and how their very cultural environment was influenced strongly by them. Evan Pritchard, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Donna. I'm here. How are
now,
you?
Evan, what I found so intriguing about this is how you call the birds allies. And I think they are just so utterly fascinating. They are just so amazing. And when I watch them here, like we have red hawks here in the Pacific Northwest where I live, and they're just so special to watch. And eagles that are in our area. And then, of course, you have the sparrows and the starlings, and you've got so many other woodpeckers, pileated and otherwise. And it's just a fascinating thing to observe them. And each and every one of the bird species have a very special place in nature. And you need to tell us how your aunt got you interested in this aspect, number one, and two, how it was so much incorporated among her people.
Well, I met her, really got to talk to her when I was about 14, which is a turning point in my life, really. And she seemed to have the ability to talk to and communicate with wild birds as well as the other kind. And it was amazing to see. It was just they would come and go and communicate with her at her animal center in Maine. And she was very proud of her Mi'kmaq heritage and taught me that it was important to preserve that heritage in all respects. And, you know, she was famous for her relationship with animals and plants, and there are books about those two things about her, but nobody had really written the bird story. She was doing bird shows from the 1920s.
Oh, my.
She was quite elderly when she passed. But she was, that got her into touch with other Native American leaders from other nations in Maine who really felt that she knew more about birds than they did. And so they, welcomed her into that, to their other nations in Maine. But she had it from her father, who was quite, kind of an underground shaman of his own way. And so she kind of, what I like to say is that she kind of pointed her bird medicine at me, and it kind of missed me and hit my sister. And so she grew up with this really great rapport with birds, whereas mine was a little weaker. But I knew it was something important to our culture. Birds are healers and messengers, musicians, weathermen or meteorologists, and all manner of different things, as you see in the bird medicine book, the stories. So when it came to me, some Native people asked me to try to establish for legal purposes what the importance of birds was in our ceremonies. And so I asked a whole number of elders at that time, it was about 3 years ago. I said, are birds important in our spirituality? And they said, yes, of course it is. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, I don't know, let me tell you a story. And then each of them told me an amazing story. And it's the stories that really show how powerful birds are as our allies. And, you know, hopefully I'll be able to share a few stories in our talk today. But they are really very unpredictable, and there's no telling what they're going to do next.
Well, I was so intrigued by so many of the details that you have in your book, one about the Native American culture. I had no knowledge about Dan Ivima, who was adamant when he was asked, because he was the last fully traditional elder of the Hopi Indians. When he was asked about the birds, he said, the birds do it all. The birds do it all. And just that tiny statement makes one wonder, what do you mean they do it all? How's that even possible? But I was intrigued with how he was considered the last Native American to live totally without dependence on the welfare system or anything else. He stood strong and tall in his own culture and in his own self-sufficiency. And I went, whoa, that is really quite an accomplishment for a man. What a legacy for him to leave. And you go into some of the different cultures, you go into the Cheyennes and so many other things, but there's a term I had no familiarity with also, T-E-K, and it's an abbreviation, tech, or it can be TIK, T-I-K. It's traditional ecological knowledge or traditional indigenous knowledge. We human beings are interesting. We come up with all kinds of stuff. This really is has become very significant, hasn't it, in being able to pass on the knowledge of the Native American culture.
Yeah, this tying those two together, Dan Ivima of the Hopi had an assistant, Kathleen Cheshire, who was my friend, otherwise known as Deb Simana, and she and I have talked a lot, and she told me all about him because she spent years as his assistant. And not only did he live off the welfare system, he lived without money, he lived without gas, without electricity. He lived only on the earth, and he was the last person that I've ever heard of, because he died in 2000, to live that way, and she, you know, helped him. And living purely on the earth like that, he had a very rare and close relationship with birds who were, in a sense, you might say, living as he lived, you see. And seeing, birds see what we do, and they respond to everything we do, but in cities, we sometimes can't see that. But he had that TEK, traditional environmental knowledge, which is, I gave a talk on TEK in Canada, about the importance of this traditional knowledge to environmentalists and scientists, how important it is. And Canada actually, Parks Canada opened up a new department called the TEK department about 6 months later from that talk, so I'm kind of proud of that. But the idea is that this is something that natives in their unique observations, such as Dan Ivima, living as birds live on the ground, to see things that scientists can't see. And they see extended relationships between birds and others in their environment and with ourselves. Because when he says they do it all, he meant, and I understand what he's saying, is that you never know what they might do to help you or warn you or give you a message. It might come in almost any way. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing they can't do, but they do it a totally different way than we would. They're very different than us, but they are certainly our allies, as I hope the book Bird Medicine shows.
Well, I know that I learned from some people who were studying wolves that I had on my show a number of years ago that they were shocked to find how the communication between different species in birds worked, and that in Canada they were way, way out in the wilderness somewhere, and there had been a kill, and the crows came to a wolf pack and let them know that there had been a kill. And then the wolves went out there, and it was the first time there had ever been an awareness of a symbiotic relationship between the crows, ravens, and the wolves. And the reason that it is there is because the birds like to feed on the marrow of the bones, but they can't crack them, and the wolves mm-hmm. can't. So
right.
there's this wonderful communication that, as people, if it hadn't been for this couple, probably that knowledge would never have been discovered. But they happened to be in the right place at the right time and found it out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the birds of four directions. That's the eagle, the hawk, the crow, and the owl. Tell us about those birds, and why were they made the symbols of the four directions, and what are the four directions?
Well, first of all, crows, I just want to comment on the last story that crows do not have the serrated teeth that some other birds and animals do, and they work in teams. Once the wolves have come in to open up the bones and also tear some of the meat, the crows have to work in teams to pull the meat strands apart. And so they're very cooperative birds, and they also warn all the animals, no matter what species. And so I just want to chime in on that wonderful story. But in terms of the four directions, this was passed to me by a Setalcot Indian member from Long Island, who explained that, you know, the four, there's a wheel of everything. There's a wheel of rocks and mammals and fish and birds. And the bird wheel is very valuable and famous, so to speak, to natives. And the eagle is in the north. They say it's because he's the top. He's on the top, you know, of the bird wheel, because he is really the king of the birds. He sees farther. He's strongest in battle. And then you look, and also very, very helpful spiritually, and goes the highest spiritually. And then in the east, the east is the color of the rising sun, which is red to our Atlantic people, and maybe not to you in the far west, but in the Atlantic region, the sun is reddest as it's coming over the ocean, and the hawk, the red-tailed hawk, has that reddish color.
Mm-hmm.
And it also tells you about the beginnings of things and what's going to happen. And then in the south is the crow, is the storyteller. And I'm not sure why the crow is in the south, but there's a Mexican crow that is a very powerful bird. It only comes, we only see in the south. And then in the west, of course, is the owl. And this makes sense to native people because, at least among the Algonquin-speaking people, the west is associated with the passing on to the spirit world. That's where the sun goes to die, as we say. And the owls have always been associated with all Native Americans with that doorway, that gateway or vortex into the underworld and the afterworld. And so they are respected as those who can give us communications from the world of the dead. And I know that you're very well aware of telepathy. And when my Aunt Helen passed away, she visited, or we'll say an owl visited her best friend, who was actually blind, 5 miles away, to tell her. And the woman went to her kitchen window, and there was this same owl that they both knew, and it was banging on the window, and she felt that there was this message, you could say telepathically, because that mm-hmm. Helen's dead. Just, she knew. And so then she asked her husband what he thought she should do. He said, wait for the phone call, and the phone rang, and it was news about Aunt Helen's passing. And so sometimes these owl messages are very dramatic and involve sometimes a degree of telepathy, and in other times extraordinary cleverness in giving us signals that we need in order to live our lives better.
I have to chuckle to myself when I'm listening to you speak about this, these details, because we have had just recently a very talkative crow that has come into our backyard, and I feel it's a female. I don't know. I haven't given it a bunny test, but I'm assuming it's female, and I just have to chuckle because the two birds, that the other two crows, which both of them I'm assuming are males, are sort of with her, but she is so vocal. Oh, my goodness. She is such a talker, and they literally have scolded me when I have not put something out for them. She was, especially. She was very adamant that this is something I was supposed to do. And I just laughed. I just laughed because they really do communicate. All of the creatures communicate in a very unique way. And the birds to me are fascinating because we have red-tailed hawk out here. We also have eagle out here. And I have been gifted with the opportunity of seeing pairs of red hawks in the sky, circling, that were just breathtakingly beautiful. Also, eaglets, which I've only seen one in the mini, one batch of four. They were just young. They were really learning to fly. And when I saw them about 3 or 4 years ago, I had to stop. And it seemed like they were following me when I was walking, and they were right over my head. It was just amazing. It was a phenomenal experience. When you have these experiences, sometimes you're afraid to talk about them to anybody because you're going to think that you're going to be laughed at. And that is not the case. At least when somebody tells me about what their experiences are, I don't laugh at it at all, because it is something, there is that communication, that telepathic communication that can come in very, very special, special ways. You have a section here just on eagles, and I have had amazing experiences with eagles. And one, I was doing a show one morning, I saw an eagle come down into our backyard and then swirl up, and I'm up on a second level, and I saw it swirl up and go up over the roof. The next time it came in, and I was in the middle of doing something with my show, here is this eagle that flies right at my eye level, and I'm looking it straight in the eye. As its wings are spread, it's looking straight at me, and it goes right by my window. Mm-hmm. I was stunned, and I had to keep doing my show. I mean, I absolutely was stunned, and I figured that he was trying to see who I was. Just, who are you? Why is this here, where you are? And then the hawks coming into the yard and watching them. I mean, it's just an incredible experience. Once you're touched by this, you can never mock, or at least in my opinion, or laugh at this. You have a lovely story about the Lynette and the eagle. Would you share that?
About the mating ritual?
Yes. Well, yes, it's where the Lynette and the eagle just kept flying, and the eagle ended up flying beyond the eagle. The Lynette ended up doing something incredible, and the eagle won the prize for the competition.
Oh, yeah, the Lynette. Well, that was an old story about the, there's a Mohawk story also about the thrush that hides on the back of the eagle during the contest, and then the one who flies the highest would have the best song. And, of course, the thrush has a wonderful song. He's hiding on his back. The eagle goes to the highest place, but then the thrush pops up, wakes up, and flies even higher. So the eagle gets no song, and the thrush gets a great one. But they found out that he cheated, so that's why he hides. He's now called the hermit thrush. I wanted to comment a little bit on about the, you talk about communication with crows. That's probably why they put crows in the south, because the south is a direction associated with the air element of communication. But also there was there's many stories about eagles. There's a story about an eagle mating ritual where they lock talons, the male and female, way up in the sky, and then they twirl and tumble down right towards the ground at a very fast speed, and then right before hitting the ground, they unlock their talons and fly away. And there's two stories in my book about that, both witnessed by Native American descendants. And in both cases, they were standing on land where their native elders and ancestors from long ago had homes and had given birth to children that produced them. I thought that was very interesting. And they, how different ways they communicate. And also, there are stories of, I'm sure you noticed, of medicine people traveling in birds, or saying that they were able to travel inside a bird and see far away. And sometimes this is an eagle that they travel in. I don't know if you noticed those stories. Benta Hansen shared a story from Australia like that. Mm-hmm. And Rolling Thunder shared a story about that through his assistant, that they're able to see through birds. And so when you see some of these amazing behaviors that some birds do, especially the eagle and the hawk, you wonder, maybe there's an ancestor trying to reach me through this bird. It seems like they know your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing what goes on within nature. Now let's talk about the hawk, because the hawk is considered a protector. And as you mentioned, on the East Coast, the red-tailed hawk is very significant. And they feel that the red-tailed hawk is very close to the eagle when it comes to symbolic power. And they're just amazing to watch. They absolutely are amazing. And there's just such a beauty with them and such a power with them. Let's talk about the Mohawks and the association with the red-tailed hawks.
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Well, you have a section, and is Moonhawk, is she...
Oh,
no,
Tony Moonhawk.
Yes, Tony Moonhawk.
Yes, he's from Long Island, Mattawak, yes. So what happened with him was that he his life wasn't going well. He had another name, and then he asked for a name. He saw a hawk flying across the full moon, and so he took the name Moonhawk and tried to start his life over, and in fact then right away met his future wife, and they were having a baby, and she was in a hospital in a suburban area in New Jersey on the upper floors. It was going very badly. The baby was going to be premature, and she was having serious medical problems that looked bad for the mother and the child. And so he left the hospital room and went downstairs, and a gigantic red-tailed hawk came, and doctors were gathering around and saying, you know, that's the biggest bird we've ever seen. And he was looking at it, and to him it was a sign that everything was going to be okay because, you know, he was Moonhawk, and there was this giant hawk that was just enormous and looking at him, and it seemed to telepathically say to him, everything's okay, go on upstairs. So he went back up to the hospital room, and all the doctors were smiling. The baby had just been born, and the mother and the baby were both healthy. And that baby is grown to normal size now, a regular little girl. And so that was a very happy moment for them. But that hawk knew his association with the hawk, you would think, and was talking to him and told him some very good news. So now he has his wife is fine and the baby's fine.
You have a story in here about a white crow. What is the symbolism with a white crow? I don't know of anybody that's ever seen one. And you have a story about a woman by the name of Kathy that has seen a white crow in Ottawa, Canada. They're an albino, but they're very rare. I would expect they're very symbolic.
Right. Well, she told me that story and another story how crows, you know, crows are warning birds, and they do this in many ways. And her particular thing is she lives in two worlds, in the white world and the native world, and sometimes it's very hard to know whether you should be on Indian time or not. So she asked the crows to give her warnings if she's late for an event, and so apparently they do. She said they give her very clear warnings to hurry up when she's late. And then while in this process, you know, she was talking to other people, and she found that people had seen a white crow, a white crow in Ottawa, an albino, I imagine. But any white bird has a spiritual connotation because there is a non-physical or metaphysical bird for each of the species which is seen in the spirit world and is white. And the white eagle is the best known and the most important one. And people will pray, so to speak, or try to communicate with the white eagle, who they say is spiritually the master of all the birds, or at least the overseer and protector of all the birds. But there's a white version of each bird, and there's a white hawk, for example. But in fact, in this physical world, there's an albino red tail, which is actually much more common than an albino crow. And the albino red tail hawk is seen, especially where I live, and various shades of white, creamy sometimes. And that's always seen as a very fortunate sign because the hawk is also a forward-looking bird that can tell you about your future and where your life is headed. So if you see a white hawk, you would think that's a blessing and also a positive good luck sign about where your life is headed. But that would be true to some extent with any bird.
Would you be able to stay with me for a little bit longer period? Because I want to go into a discussion about cell towers and birds and things like this. And I know we're going to be getting close, so I'm glad you're able to stay with me. But I wanted to bring up the a factor of the owl, because this is the other beautiful, beautiful bird. And I know that we have neighbors where an owl is in residence. And there have been some years where we haven't had the owls, and usually that's when the rodent population is very low. Mm-hmm. And then when the happy little rats and mices are out there doing their thing, they are here, and we'll hear them. And I just think they're beautiful, beautiful birds, but they're sometimes hard to spot. And you talk about in your book about the story about a girl and how her father took her out in the forest with a bow and arrow to teach her how to hunt for birds for food.
Yeah.
But hadn't yet taught her because she was very young, but she ended up being mm-hmm. quite skilled. And so he then had to teach her about what to shoot and what not to shoot. Go into that a little bit.
Well, actually, that was my mother, raised in somewhat of the Mi'kmaq tradition. And what happened was he said, just, you know, first time out, just shoot at anything and you'll probably miss it. And so she had the bow and arrow and they were out in the bush and this Arctic owl flew over her head, which is a white bird, very sacred among owls, not an albino, but a naturally white species. And she mm-hmm. just let it go and shot the bird on instinct. And then when she saw, I mean, she shot it dead right out of the sky, and it was a remarkable shot. And she was very young, but the effect was kind of the opposite of what he had expected, because after that, seeing that she had killed this bird, she'd never wanted to hunt again. And so she didn't actually hunt, you know, with bow and arrow. She stopped that. And so mm-hmm. Had the opposite effect. But, you know, there also are teachings among our people that those who are on a spiritual path shouldn't hunt but should have other ways. I mean, I think fishing is different. But, you know, really focusing on plant medicine, for mm-hmm. example. So my mother is still here with us and a very spiritual person. And she has never hunted since.
Fascinating.
But that's also part of our tradition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break for a moment. This is Donna Sebo. My guest today is Evan Pritchard. His wonderful book is called Bird Medicine, and there's a gorgeous hawk on the cover, The Sacred Power of Bird Shamanism. Stay with me because we're going to learn how the modern-day world is affecting birds and how we are going to have to perhaps come up with some solutions with our environment so that we can live together more compatibly than we are at this time. This is Donna Sebo with Evan Pritchard. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Do you have a product or service that you would like people to know about? Internet radio is a powerful medium that can assist you in reaching people who like to shop online and pass by electronic word of mouth information about you, your products, and or services. The Donna Sebo Show reaches around the world, and you can be part of that enterprising network. For more information, contact Vision Broadcasting via Donna at DelphiInternational.com
or call 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo. We are talking with Evan Pritchard. Bird Medicine is the book. And if you have a love for nature, if you enjoy birds, this is a book that absolutely is fascinating. Goes into shamanism, why it's been important to various cultures. Evan, I wanted to bring up the effect of the modern world on the lifestyle, if you will, of many creatures. And one of the most significant facts that you brought out, and it affects human beings too, is cell towers. And we have these humongous electric units, transmission units, that all of us are very much dependent upon. But it really has had a very adverse effect, not just on birds, but insects, on animals, and this is a science that is going to be growing, and I think we're eventually going to figure out how to utilize energy so that it's not going to be so harmful. But let's go into that discussion, because birds are so important. They are so very, very important in the overall scheme of things, as I feel every species is. But you bring this out, and why is this important?
Well, in the book, I talk about a number of different types of hazards to birds that are fairly new and recent, including the Gulf oil spill, of course. But I think what stands out is the section about cell towers. There is a man, a scientist in Spain called Alphonse Balmori, who's been doing studies for years, well-funded, well, very highly professionally conducted studies that, you know, many, many cases. And he found that there are a number of ways that cell towers interfere with birds' lives and, in fact, can lead to their deaths. And there's a list of 10 in the book. First of all, the cell towers, the transmissions, drive away the birds. Some more than others, like the raptors, are more likely just to go away and not be in the area where the towers are erected. But smaller birds are forced to seek refuge in tiny holes in buildings and nooks and crannies, because they apparently, well, they act as if these radiations hurt them, and so they avoid them, but then they can't come out of those little holes, and so they're imprisoned in them, which is very sad, but also, you know, they can't eat. Another thing that happens is very interesting is, of course, they lose their direction when they go through these transmissions at most angles. Because they would get permanently lost and not able to return to their nests or their families, because their navigational systems are incredibly complicated. You know, there are trace metals in their heads, and also chemicals upon the surfaces of their eyes, and these are affected by these radiations and they get lost. So another thing that happens is they become confused. And Balmori talks a lot about white storks in Spain, very famous for building their nests on the chimneys and in trees.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's near a cell tower, they get terribly confused. They drop all the sticks. They can't remember how to build the nest. And then they start fighting with their mates. And, of course, they never build the nest, and the eggs drop to the ground. So that's one. Another, of course, this is very important, is that in the nest, when they make them, various birds find they have smaller hatchings with fewer eggs with each period, and then the embryos are less likely to be fertile. So that's the first five. That's pretty bad. But then also you find that Balmori says that they become crippled and their legs can become limp and their wings can malfunction if they've spent a lot of time around salt towers. Of course, often it finds that they crash into the salt towers and they're found dead near the towers. But then what you mention is also that in the presence of salt towers, the mice will also struggle, and they'll be deformed when they're born, and smaller litters with each generation. And so with the loss of mice, like you said about the owls, the birds will stop coming to that area. The same with insects. And also it's interesting that we were talking about coloration, but in the presence of cell towers, birds can become white or black, even if it's not their natural color, after radiation. So this is just mm-hmm. the 10 top 10 worst things about cell towers in birds.
Well, something that I don't think many people are aware of, and I've learned this from some medical specialists, is that people that go up to work on the cell towers, repair them, build them, the incidence of cancer among those individuals is quite high. And typically they're men. They don't have women doing this. They're men. So testicular cancer and some other things really do have an effect. And again, it's the radiation level. And this is something that, because you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it, you have to have a sophistication and understanding of radiation properties so that you know how to measure it. And I think eventually there is going to be the understanding that there has to be a different way of being able to utilize the energy so that you don't create such a negative result. There's a man that you speak of in your book. He's passed on now, Alexei Kondratiev. And he was a scholar and a linguist who was very much immersed with indigenous populations, including the Ojibwe and the Innu of northern Quebec. But when he died, it was, you use the words, it was as if an encyclopedia of wisdom died with him. Tell us the story about this man and the experience that some people had relative to him and the birds after his death.
Well, he, as a linguist, he related to the mockingbird, who speaks all the languages of all the birds. So he always identified with that. And he also was working on a book about Bridget the day he died. And it was on his person, the manuscript. But he was obviously editing it. And Bridget's colors, I guess the blackbird as colored black. And there's also white underneath the mockingbird. There's a story, I don't remember all the details, but when he, when his students came to the spot where he had been found, this is in New York City, they found that those birds flew up and landed on a rose bush, which has the color red, which is another color of Bridget, and the, all those colors coming together was a message. So I felt that, and others felt, that he was not only giving him a lesson about bird language, which he was familiar with, the kind of we're talking about, but also in their calls, but also teaching them about Bridget and her symbols, and also maybe saying that he was traveling now in the spirit world with Bridget, and that birds were bringing the message. And these things like this are happening right down in New York City. These birds, a lot of the stories are actually in New York City, and hawks and eagles can appear anywhere in an urban environment or in the wild. And there's stories about harriers showing up in downtown, like near Washington, D.C., and doing, you know, bringing messages. It's like there's something rather supernatural about some of these stories that, you know, it doesn't seem to matter where you are, that it can just show up and drop a message on you. And One time I was, you know, on the beach and in Maine, and a seagull came and dropped a fish at my feet. And I threw the fish back because I wasn't hungry, but I always remember that. And 40 years later, I learned that my Mi'kmaq grandfather used to pray at that very spot with his tobacco at sunrise, because that's where the sun came up. And sometimes we don't understand at first what the message is, and it takes a while, so we have to be very attentive and have memories like the birds have. It's very long memories. And try to help them with these environmental hazards. And yes, with these cell phone towers, they're very unregulated, and the amount of the amplitude of these frequencies is not generally known or reported, and that's the first thing that we should do, is let's know what the levels are that we're dealing with. It'll help the birds. It'll help us as well.
You have a fun story in here about the magpie burglar alarm, and this is what you call the husband-wife folk duo, original from Tacoma Park, Maryland, and they just had a wonderful story to tell about magpies. In fact, you published it in 1992 in the Renaissance,
Resonance
magazine. And tell us about this, because magpies are characters.
Yes, yes, and the name of the group was Magpie, and that it still is. And so they were feeding the birds and bread, and so Greg is the male of the group, and his wife passed bread to him, and she was taking a film of it on camera, and it hopped on top of the car, and the bird hopped on the back trunk and took the bread, but did not eat it, but stuffed it under the flap of his hip pack, where the zipper was open, and so the magpie put the bread into his pack on his hip, which was very, you know, kind of bold. He took the bread out and handed it back to the bird, thinking that he couldn't understand that it was a gift, but the bird was trying to make a point. So he ate the bread, but then he hopped over to him again and pecked at his zipper somewhat furiously, you know, the same zipper. And so he began to walk away, and the bird jumps off the car back over to him again. He's just not getting the point, and he picks a small pebble off the ground and tucks it under the flap of his shoes. So and he put it on. The bird landed on his foot and wouldn't leave. So this magpie was being extremely persistent, and then, like, for an entire minute, and then he hopped off again. They couldn't figure out what was going on. So he checked that pocket and remembered that was where he usually placed the keys to the rental car. And he discovered the keys were not there. And he looked through his pockets. They weren't there. He looked around. His wife didn't have the keys. And then he looked at the car door, and there were the keys hanging from the door for anyone to take. And inside the car were several thousand dollars worth of instruments, because they are on tour. So that's, I think, a really interesting story, and it shows you what lengths birds can go to help humans, and how deeply they understand our technological lives somehow to help
us. Absolutely. And at the University of Washington, here in the state of Washington, they did a study, it was quite extensive, on crows. And they found that crows can identify people. And I know that for a fact, because they've followed me sometimes when I'm out on walks. And they know they can identify people. They'd try to cover things up. The crows always knew who they were. And it was something that they did not recognize, the intelligence of these birds. Just because they can't speak our language, so to speak, then we assume that they, many times, it is the assumption, I don't, but I know many people do, that they're dumb animals, and they're anything but that. They're exceptionally intelligent, exceptionally intelligent. So your book, Bird Medicine, Evan, is just absolutely fascinating. And all of the different tribes and the different stories that you share, and the understanding about how important it is for us to take care of the environment so that our feathered friends do stay with us, because they have so much to offer. What is your website that people can go to find out more about the work you do?
Well, thanks for asking. It's www.algonquinculture.org. I'll spell it. It's algonquinculture.org. And there should be information. If you scroll down, you'll see bird medicine and information about that and some of my other books. And I have many books out about Native American culture and the environment.
Well, this has been a delight, Evan. Thank you for spending extra time with me. The Sacred Power of Bird Shamanism, Bird Medicine. Cultures around the world honor and respect this for good reason. And I think you would love having this book in your library. It can become something that you refer to on many different occasions. Fascinating stories, a fascinating subject. Evan Pritchard, thank you for being my guest. It's been a delight. Go to algonquinculture.org, and you'll find out more information about this wonderful subject and many other things that Evan has written about. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be right back.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number, if you'd like to call in and chat with me, is 888-627-6008. 008. That's 888-627-6008. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about how you can power up your health. Dr. Wiley is going to be my guest. This is a man that not only does he work with bodybuilders, but he's deeply involved with nutrition and components that, well, he feels that can enable us to really do more for ourselves on the physical level so that we can be at our best on our mental and emotional level as well. So I think you'll enjoy that. And then we're going to be talking about a wonderful dog. She's a healing dog. Her name is Tassel. That's right. Rosemary Stevenson is going to be my guest. And we are going to be chatting with her about this wonderful animal that, oh, it's just such a special story, so you're not going to want to miss it. By the way, all of the listing of the guests are up now, and so you can go in to show information and check out who is coming up on the Donna Sebo Show. A little bit of trivia that I wanted to share with you. And by the way, if you want to call me, 888-627-6008. A game. How could a game enable prisoners of war escape? Well, this is what happened during World War II. The Nazis, they did something with the Allied prisoners of war that I wouldn't have thought was any big deal. They obviously didn't think it was a big deal either. What was it? Allowing the prisoners to play board games. Now, the British government was even allowed to send its incarcerated soldiers a game or two. Now, can you imagine what those games were? We're talking World War II. Well, I was surprised to find out that one of those two games was Monopoly. Mm-hmm. We all are familiar with Monopoly. It's in various forms today. And inside the box of Monopoly, what do you think you'd find? Well, probably those little wooden houses and the dice and no big deal. However, inside that game were tools for escape. Yes, doesn't your imagination go a little wild with that? Specifically, the British government, with the cooperation of the game's publisher, hid real banknotes among the Monopoly money. That's right. Compasses, metal files, and a folded silk map, which was less likely to disintegrate than a paper one, were also concealed inside the box to help the POWs flee their captors. And it worked. Yes. Ingenuity. A map on silk. fascinating. This makes for all of these stories that come out from people and how they survived and what they did and how they managed to put information out and not be detected by an enemy. We hear so much stuff on the news today about secrets being passed along to people, and I guess a future generation will probably look at some of our experiences with technology that we're going through today as being the trivia in the future, like we are looking at some of the trivia I just shared with you today. It's fascinating stuff. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. By the way, I have got a recipe here that I really want to share with you. Summertime is a time for lighter fare, and I think salads are absolutely wonderful. And this is a salad with burrata. Have you ever heard of that? I hadn't heard of it. It's a specific type of cheese, tomatoes, candied pecans, and a mixed green salad. How does that sound to you? Well, let me give you the recipe for the dressing. It's real simple. This could go with any salad. It's a half a cup of virgin olive oil and a quarter of a cup of balsamic vinegar. Shake it up, and you got your dressing. Boom! The salad. You're going to need about 5 ounces of mixed green baby lettuce, or whatever your favorite mixed lettuce is. You want it colorful. You want some of the red and with the green and the white. Then you're going to need 1 pound of small tomatoes, and you want to cut them in half. You could use cherry tomatoes, you know, whatever you want. It's just little tomatoes. If you don't have any little tomatoes, cut a big tomato into small pieces. Use your imagination. But you're going to need 1/2 cup of candied pecans. Oh, they're so yummy. And then you're going to need 2 balls, and they're about 4 ounces each, of burrata. And that's spelled B-U-R-R-A-T-A. Or you can use fresh mozzarella cheese. So basically what you're going to need is 1/2 pound of cheese. So again, if you didn't like mozzarella, if you didn't like burrata, use something else. You could use a spicy cheese if you wanted. You could use any kind of cheese. It's up to you. You can adapt this recipe. It's still going to be yummy. And of course, you want to have a little bit of salt and freshly cracked pepper. And all you do is take all of those fresh ingredients, including those candied pecans. Oh, they're magical when you add them to a salad. And what I do with candied pecans is put them in a small sandwich bag. And you're going to need about, I cheat. I add more candied pecans. 1/2 cup? You've got to be kidding. Come on, we're going to add a little bit more. So I take a mallet and I crush them. So they're in chunks, not real itsy-bitsy chunks, but in chunks. And it seems to go further, and there's more of a disbursement in the salad itself. Oh, that is almost like a magical ingredient, candied pecans. Now, if you don't like pecans, then find some candied walnuts or even candied almonds. See, the salad has a dimension to it, but it's light, it's flavorful, and with freshly baked bread. And then why not fix one of your favorite desserts to go with it? And you could be decadent with a dessert, right? You betcha, because you've had a very light meal. And this is going to serve 4 people or 2 people quite nicely. But I wanted to share that with you today. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. We have had just such a wonderful guest today talking about these very special feathered friends of ours. All of nature has a very significant value. And I think when we can really understand that we live in a symbiotic environment and we produce and take care to make sure that our environments are safe for those birds, our lives are richer because of it. You are the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. And remember, your soul beams out a light that touches everything and everyone around you. Thank you so much for being with me today. Enjoy the spectacular day of life that you have. And won't you join me again tomorrow? And be sure and tell your friends about the show, too. We've got a lot of good things to share. We're going to power up your health tomorrow. Donna Sebo here. Take care. God bless. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.